Two things by way of introduction. One is that it is doubtful whether any of you are not aware of the influences of feminism and the kind of issues that underlie our consideration or our consideration of this matter, the Puritan woman, or that underlie the reason, I suppose, I was originally asked to give the lecture to the Westminster Conference. I don't know how far, it depends how well informed you are as to the vast changes that have taken place over recent years and the perception, if you like, of the role of women and their relationship with men and so forth. But if you are, you will know that enormous changes have taken place in the last 30 or so years, and these changes affect every kind of area of life, no doubt the family, the school, and not least the church, I suspect. Changes which are fundamental and also, to some degree, productive of chaos. Chaos, I say chaos deliberately. I happen to be, have something to do with a school and was on a committee, subcommittee to do with sex education, and with no wish to be in any way speaking inappropriately, I asked whether they would like to tell me what a man and a woman were, because I thought this was fairly fundamental to what we were talking about. No one ventured any attempt at an answer, although they were set upon teaching children. But I wasn't quite clear what they were going to teach them, since they didn't seem to be too clear what a woman was and what a man was. Now, I don't know how they took me as a minister asking this question, but it was a very serious question, because I said, well, if you don't know what a man is and what a woman is, how on earth are you going to talk about the relationship between one and the other? So there is utter confusion here. The other thing I want to say by way of introduction is this is a lecture, not a sermon. I'm happy to preach sermons and to expound the Word of God, and those who preach sermons should begin by reading from the Bible, by citing the Bible, and by expounding what the Bible teaches. That is not what I was asked to do, not trying to do it. I was asked to give a lecture upon the Puritan woman, which, as you perceive, is historical. But I hope you'll find, of course, there are biblical principles underlying my examination of this matter. So much for the introduction then. Who can find a virtuous woman? For her price is far above rubies. It's Proverbs 31, verse 10. Nobody minds me saying that, do they? None of you mind me saying that, particularly the ladies present. Who's a virtuous woman is very, very valuable. Who can find, though, it says, a virtuous woman? Who can find a virtuous woman? If you're a man, if I may say so, it's a good idea if you're not married that you're looking for one. And let us hope if you are married you have found one. I'm sure many would say here that that is the case, that their wives are worth far more than rubies. I happen to have the responsibility of marrying one of my daughters. I've got three daughters. Whether that qualifies me to speak about the Puritan woman, I don't know. They found it somewhat amusing when I was asked to do so, I ought to say. But I said, well, I'm afraid I can't give you a wife with a fortune. I can't do that. But I said, that is speaking to the man who is marrying her. But I can give you a fortune in a wife. Because as far as I'm concerned, anyone who gets any of my daughters is getting a fortune. And I mean that very seriously. Well, while our perspective is historical, yet our quest is biblical and, of course, eminently practical. A virtuous woman glorifies God, is a blessing to her husband, to her children, and a fountain of blessedness to society round her, and an ornament and honour to the Church of Christ. But where shall we find such a woman, or to be more precise, such women? To go back to the Puritan era is no disparagement to modern Christian womanhood. However, surrounded as she is by the strident voice of feminism and cries for women's rights, It would be folly if we ignored the kind of Christian women produced by revivals which took place at the Reformation and the Puritan era which grew out of it. What is interesting is that in this era, there was a remarkable unanimity of what constitutes a good wife. This is untrue in our present era. It's not only that the world is racked with the ideas of feminists of varying hues, but the evangelical constituency itself is not free from significant differences over the role of women in the family, the church, and society. From some perspectives, the church in our land, and evangelical churches in particular, are not free from this. And they have become perilously, there is a perilously effeminate air about some of them. Women, whether you, I don't know whether there's an opportunity to ask questions or to dissent from what I'm saying. I didn't hear, but it wasn't said. I mean, you may want to disagree with me. I don't mind people incidentally disagreeing with me. If you want to disagree with me, disagree with me. If I can't defend myself, then I ought to be ashamed of myself. Anyway, what I'm saying is the evangelical churches in particular are not free from this, but they have a perilously effeminate air about it. Women, whether de jure or de facto, have exercised such a control or such an influence that men outside the church see it as a place of children, women, and the elderly. I think this is a true statement. While, of course, the church, we are not to be governed by the world's opinion of the church, yet it would be foolish to ignore how much such a view is a hindrance among men to the hearing of the gospel. I'm just throwing out sort of issues which arise from the sort of thing we're considering. However, Antonia Fraser's writing of the death of Elizabeth Cavendish, Countess of Bridgewater, who died at the age of 37, and was described, among others, as a most affectionate, observing wife to her husband, a most tender and indulgent mother to her children, a most kind and bountiful mistress to her family. In a word, she was so superlatively good that language is too narrow to express her deserved character. Now, Antonia Fraser then adds a most perceptive comment. There was indeed a remarkable unanimity in the nature of such tributes for all the religious differences which bedeviled the structure of society. The qualities which were to make up a right royal crown to her husband were not much in dispute. I think it's interesting. If you know Antonia Fraser, certainly no evangelical. She comes from a Roman Catholic family. But it's very interesting. She said among all kinds of shades of religious opinion, in the early 17th century and so on, there was a unanimous agreement about what constituted a good wife. Society had a very clear view then. And if you grew up as a woman, or you grew up as a man, there was a degree of unanimity which certainly, as I say, did not exist today. Now, where shall we begin? First, let us hear part of a letter. I've now sent you, my dear sister Catherine, a book, which, although it be not outwardly trimmed with gold, or the various embroidery of the artfulest needles, yet inwardly it is more worth than all the precious mines which the vast world can boast of. It is a book, my only best and best beloved sister, of the law of the Lord. It is the testament and last will which he bequeathed unto us wretches and wretched sinners, which will lead you in the path of eternal joy. And if you with good mind read it, and with an earnest desire follow it, no doubt shall bring you to an immortal and everlasting life. It will teach you to live and learn you to die, my good sister. And more again, let me entreat thee to learn to die. Deny the world, defy the devil, and despise the flesh, and delight yourself only in the Lord. Be penitent for your sins, and yet despair not. Be strong in faith, yet presume not. And desire with St. Paul to be dissolved and to be with Christ, with whom even in death there is life. Farewell once again, my beloved sister, and put your only trust in God, who only must help you. Amen. Second, let us hear part of a prayer by the same person. O Lord, thou God and Father of my life, hear me, poor and desolate woman, which liveth unto thee only in all troubles and miseries. Thou, Lord, art the only defender and deliverer of those that put their trust in thee. And therefore, being defiled with sin, encumbered with miseries, vexed with temptations, and grievously tormented with the long imprisonment of this vile mass of clay, My sinful body do come unto thee, O merciful Saviour, craving thy mercy and help, without the which so little hope of deliverance is left that I may utterly despair of my liberty. Suffer me not to be tempted above my power, but either be thou a deliverer unto me out of this great misery, or else give me grace patiently to bear thy heavy hand and sharp correction. Hear me, O merciful Father, for his sake, whom thou wouldest be a sacrifice for my sins, to whom with thee and the Holy Ghost be all honour and glory. Amen. Thirdly, part of an account of the same woman. The date is the Monday, the 12th of February, 1554. Place the Tower of London. The subject of the account, a young, shall we call her a Puritan, if not technically and in spirit, woman of 16 years. She may have been 17 because actually the precise date of her birth is not known. But if she was 17, she was only just 17. So I don't know whether any 16 or 17-year-old young ladies present here, but she was your exact contemporary. 16. And she wrote what she wrote at that age. The place is the Tower of London. As soon as her husband, because she's married, had been beheaded on Tower Hill, I presume if you're historically instructed, you'll know whom I'm speaking about by now, but if you don't, wait, I'll tell you at the end. The sheriff's come to escort her to the scaffold. Well, she's going to have her head cut off. On the way, it seems almost certain she passed the headless corpse of her husband being brought back in a cart from execution. As she is led to the place of execution by Sir John Bridges, the lieutenant of the Tower, she is praying, although according to Fox's Book of Martyrs, she is continually interrupted by Feckenham, who is trying to persuade her to renounce her Protestant faith and recant. Having come to the scaffold, the executioner now fell on his knees and begged her forgiveness, which she most willingly granted him. Seeing the block, her resolution is not affected, but she asks him to dispatch her quickly. She herself tied the handkerchief over her eyes and felt for the block, being guided by a bystander. She laid her head on it, and stretching forth her body, exclaimed, Lord, into thy hands I commend my spirit. Immediately the axe fell, and the world closed forever on one of the most interesting women which adorned it. This, of course, was none other than Lady Jane Grey, who died affirming that she died a true Christian woman, and she expected salvation only through the mercy of God in the merits of the blood of his Son, Jesus Christ. Here is a pattern of true Puritan womanhood, a product of her ages, singularly intellectual, reading the Phaedo of Plato in Greek in her room, when others were hunting in the park, immensely strictly brought up, submissive to her parents because of the situation she got into because of her father's ambition, and yet in adversity showing true perseverance and a costly attachment to the doctrine she professed. Historically, we may see that the doctrinal springs and influences which produce this kind of woman, we must go to Geneva. Geneva under the influence of Calvin, and his ideas has a surprising reputation. Le Paradis, forgive my French, des femmes, because the consistory acted against forced betrothal between grown men and girls under age and with ill-treated and deserted wives. Let us say that I like to shoot at a lot of targets as I go along. I don't know whether you thought that Calvinists were harsh on women, but certainly those around Geneva said it was the paradise of women because they were so well looked after there and so protected. That was the testimony of those who didn't like it. They weren't the friends of Geneva. They said, oh, this is a paradise of women. Calvin himself has left a resume of his own views on what is required in a good wife. Concerning the marriage, I shall now, this is quoting from a letter. Concerning the marriage, I shall now speak more plainly. Previous to the departure of Michael, I do not know whether anyone made mention of that person concerning whom I wrote. But always keep in mind what I seek to find in her. For I'm none of those insane lovers who embrace also the vices of those they are in love with, when they are smitten at first sight with a fine figure. This only is the beauty which allures me, if she is chaste, if not too nice or fastidious, if economical, if patient, if there is hope that you'll be interested about my health. I don't know whether you look for that in a wife, or whether if you are a lady and a man is going to wants to marry you, you're going to be pleased that he wants to marry you so that you might take an interest in his health. And Calvin is supposed to have had about 30 to 35 different complaints at some time. However, it says here, therefore, if you think well of it, set out immediately in case someone else get beforehand with you. But if you think otherwise, we may let that pass. However, even Calvin, as is frequently the case, did not find the discovery of a suitable wife easy. Writing in March 1540, just under a year later, he writes, "We are as yet in a state of suspense as to the marriage, and this annoys me exceedingly. For as much as the relations of that young lady of rank are so urgent that I may take her unto myself, which indeed I would never think of doing unless the Lord had altogether demented me." He didn't sort of mince his words. I don't know who the young lady was. Later we know he married Idelette de Bure, by whom he had at least three children, although they died. Her death left him all desolate, as he wrote to Vire. "Although the death of my wife has been bitterly painful to me, yet I restrain my grief as well as I can. You well know well enough how tender or rather soft my mind is." I don't know what you think of Calvin. That's your image of Calvin. Listen to what he says. "Had I not exercised a powerful self-control, therefore, I could not have borne up so long. And truly mine is no common grief. I have been bereaved of the best companion of my life, who, if any severe hardship had occurred, would have been my willing partner, not only in exile and poverty, but even in death. As long as she lived, she was the faithful helper of my ministry. From her I never felt even the slightest hindrance. During the whole course of her illness, she was more anxious about her children. But she had been previously married. She was a widow, so they were by her previous husband. In the whole course of her illness, she was most anxious about her children, more anxious than about herself. Since I was afraid that she might torment herself needlessly by repressing her worry, 3 days before her death, I took occasion to mention that I would not neglect my duties to her children. She spoke up at once, 'I have already committed them to God.'" It's appropriate just to glance briefly at the view of women prior to Calvin, which is to be found in the Catholicism influenced by Thomas Aquinas. I hope you're beginning to understand this is a vast subject, you see. You start to look at these things, and you have to say, well, what did other people think about women? What was the view that prevailed before the Reformation and the Puritan era? I'm quoting here from the writings of the angelic doctor, Aquinas: "Women as a group and generality emerge as inferior to man in every aspect of her being. Psychologically, she is inferior, since St. Thomas perpetuates the Aristotelian concept of women as misshaped and half-formed man. The relative weakness of her reason is emphasized, and from this weakness follows greater susceptibilities of her soul to the disorder of sin. These views must also be seen in connection with the Catholic exaltation of celibacy, and we will have some background against which it would be possible to assess the changes which Puritanism has wrought in the concept of the truly virtuous woman." And I just make an aside here. One of the things you have to ask yourself is what views of women are held elsewhere? And what views of the role of women are held elsewhere? What role of women in Islam, for instance? Where do women stand in Islam? I'm amazed to find some women who espouse Islam. They don't seem to understand what it teaches about their position. If we take Geneva and Lady Jane Grey as a kind of starting point, where should we make the terminus of our studies? We could hardly do better than to make it with the life of Catherine Brown, whom Thomas Boston married on the 17th of July, 1700. Writing after 30 years of married life, Boston describes her as, I'm quoting his words from his own journal, "a woman of great worth, whom I therefore passionately loved and inwardly honored, a stately, beautiful, and comely personage, truly pious and fearing the Lord, of an even temper, patient in our common tribulation and under her personal distresses, a woman of bright natural parts, an uncommon stock of prudence, of a quick and lively apprehension in things of she applied herself to, great presence of mind in surprising incidents, sagacious and cute in discerning the qualities of persons, a very useful thing to have in a wife, I can assure you, but naturally cheerful, wise, and affable of conversation, having a good faculty at speaking and expressing herself with assurance, endowed with a singular dexterity in dictating letters, being a pattern of frugality and wise management of her household affairs. Therefore, entirely committed to her, well fitted for and careful of the virtuous education of her children, useful through her skill in physic and surgery, which in many instances a peculiar blessing appeared to be commanded upon from heaven, and fully a crown to my public station and appearance. Actually, if you read, though, Boston then goes on to describe the terrible mental distresses his wife went through, which only go to heighten the value of the foregoing testimony. Very difficult to find out about it. If you can read the Boston's journals and the mental troubles his wife had, particularly in connection with childbirth, are there. It's not easy to understand. He wrote his journals not for publication, so they weren't written to be read by anybody. And therefore he doesn't sort of provide you with the details that you might wish for, but she seemed to know tremendous spiritual distresses and darkness, which as far as I can understand, she certainly didn't come out of before his death. He prayed for, he fasted, and she seemed sometime to make some kind of recovery. But if you think to yourself, if you read that, and then you read, far be it from me to speak as an emotional man, but I almost wept when I read that. I thought, what a tribute from a man after 30 years marriage to his wife. What a wonderful tribute to a woman. What an exalted tribute to a woman. I mean, I read this years ago before I was going to lecture upon this, but I was absolutely delighted with it. I thought one of the most moving tributes I've ever read in my life. It may appear from a comparison between the execution of Lady Jane Grey with the life of Catherine Boston in Ettrick at the beginning of the 18th century, that while the life of Puritan women in the early years was one of potential danger and violent death, yet in later years this was not so. Certainly by 1700 the character of life was changing. Right up till that day the lives of Puritan women could know a danger today only to be found in areas of war and revolution. In March 1696 we read of the Indians attacking Haverhill, I suppose that's how it's pronounced, in New England, killing 27 people, including 13 children. The wife of Thomas Dustin was in bed having given birth to her 12th child. A few days earlier, she was dragged from her house and her baby murdered in front of her eyes. Actually, if you read, there's so many things I'd like to give you in detail. What is amazing, the Indians killed her child in front of her. And then she was dragged off by the Indians. I think that her husband fled with the other children, but she couldn't. So he, to protect the other younger children, fled. But she actually was taken with the Indians many, many miles. And believe it or not, and this shocks the sort of politically correct feminists of North America, with a boy there, when the Indians became less careful, they got up in the night and they killed a number of them and escaped. So she was obviously a woman of some resolution. And she said that she had never known such a sense of the presence of God as she did when she was being abducted as a prisoner of the Indians, with no knowing what was going to happen to her in the end. In Scotland, while many know of the martyrdoms of the two Margarets, Margaret McLaughlin and Margaret Wilson, who was only about 18 years old, yet the hanging of Marion Harvey and Isabel Allison are not so well known. They were just ordinary servant, really, girl. And they were apprehended coming into Edinburgh, having done nothing at all. They were executed at the Grass Market in January 1681, for expressing opinions and doing nothing else, which was objectionable to the authorities. The authorities examined them and asked them about their beliefs, and they refused to give the appropriate answers concerning the royal supremacy, so they were hanged. And hanged, incidentally, among women who were child murderers and the most, women being executed for terrible crimes, but they committed no crime at all, except to assert that Jesus Christ was truly head of the church and solely head of the church. Also less known, well known, was the execution of a godly woman, Lady Lyle, who was beheaded for giving hospitality to a man implicated in the Monmouth Rebellion. Although she thought he was only in trouble for preaching, She was beheaded on the 2nd of September 1685 in the marketplace at Winchester. She was an aristocrat, which is... Elizabeth Gaunt, charged with a similar offence, was burnt alive at Tyburn on the 23rd of October 1685. Macaulay wrote of this, "It was much noticed that while the foulest judicial murder which had disgraced even those times was perpetrating, a tempest burst forth, since has not been known since that great hurricane which had raged round the deathbed of Oliver. Since that day no woman has suffered death in England for any political offence, but her only offence was giving a sort of physical help to those who were nonconformists in trouble with the authorities. And she was burnt alive for that." Puritan women then lived in times of distress, war, persecution, danger, and great difficulty. In these times they showed forth the evidences of God's grace and submission to God's word. So that's the sort of basic introduction. Before going on to examine different aspects of the life of the Puritan woman, it is necessary to deal with several preliminary matters. First of all, the issue of sources. Where do we learn about them, that is? Where do we learn what they were like? This recent study by David Cressy quotes women as a whole, they were not analysed by class, as displaying the same high level of illiteracy as labourers and husbandmen. A figure of 90% illiteracy amongst women is given for London in the favourable areas in 1600, declining in 1640 quite sharply to around 80%. In East Anglia, at the same period, female illiteracy is given as nearly 100%. Interestingly enough, Puritan women aristocrats saw it their duty to instruct their maids to read so that they could at least read the Bible or Psalms. For example, a forlorn creature came to Elizabeth Walker's door who only knew her name was Mary Bunn. I quote, "Almost as eat up with scabs and vermin with scarce rags to cover her, and as ignorant of God and Christ as if she'd been born and bred in Lapland or Japan." Elizabeth Walker decided to save her not only by stripping her, washing her, and curing her of the itch, but also by teaching her to read, so that finally a rich farmer took Mary Bunn as his apprentice. We do, of course, have Bunyan's description of typical Puritan women in Pilgrim's Progress, and his perspective was that of a minister of a congregation of the relatively poor. Nevertheless, much of our written records of Puritan women came from the writing of letters of female members of the aristocracy or squirearchy. It just couldn't be otherwise. If women couldn't write, most of them couldn't. No, most men couldn't write either. The only sort of historical records basically you're going to get are those written by those who were literate, and they tended to come from the very upper echelons of society. I just say that to you. It's one of the difficulties of really finding out what things were like. This leads us to another significant issue, that of the importance of class distinctions in the Puritan era. First, let it be remembered that unlike today, there were many aristocratic families of the landed gentry who were strongly Puritan. And in such matters as marriage, this certainly affected the approach of fathers, the arrangements of the marriages of their daughters. Also, distinctions of status in society were far more marked than they are now. Women have always been, and no doubt still are, interested in clothes. If you've got any daughters, I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that. The Puritan, or perhaps you learnt it from, I've got this sort of kind of mind, perhaps you've learnt it from your wife, I don't know. If you didn't know it before you were married. And I'm not saying, this is no condemnation. It fascinates me, actually. It fascinates me. I like to make little asides, it's a lecture. You see, it fascinates me that little girls, and you don't instruct them to be interested in what they wear. They are so by nature. It seems to come naturally to them. And my children never liked me using them as examples, but I never taught them to be interested in shopping. That's not one of my great sort of pedagogic activities as a Christian father. Teach daughters shopping is important. But they somehow pick it up by nature. I don't know where they get it from. There we are. I'm just saying, the Puritan era was no exception. In the late 17th century in New England, we find John Hutchins' wife was admonished for wearing a silk hood, while two daughters of Hannah Bosworth were fined 10 shillings each for wearing silk. I don't really understand the sort of society they lived in. Society was far more rigorously controlled. These sumptuary laws imported from Europe, this is New England, were intended primarily to maintain the outward distinction between the social orders, not for religious purposes. So they weren't in trouble because wearing silk was against Puritan views. It was because they weren't of sufficiently high social status to wear silk. If you were of that, well, you could wear silk. But if you didn't, you were just getting a little above yourself. More astonishing, but nevertheless probably arising partly from issues of social distinction, was that has been called the Millinery War. I don't know, I don't want to ask whether anyone knows what I'm going to talk about. The Millinery War. This is true. This is Francis Thompson, the leader of the separatist congregation associated with Henry Barrow, had in 1594 married Thomasina Boys, the widow of a rich Fleet Street haberdasher who had died as a martyr. His brother, George, who was in prison, was infuriated by Thomasina's outward adornment. She was, quote, a bouncing girl, really like the wife of the Bishop of London. She wore 3, 4, or 5 gold rings at once. I'm sorry, ladies, I sort of think to myself, you start to cover your hands up as I say this. George thought that she should take off her excessive deal of lace, exchange her showish hat for a sober taffety and felt, and stop wearing musk and fancy white ruff stiff with starch, the devil's liquor. Thomasina bluntly told George to mind his own business. And this is absolutely true. He then excommunicated her, no doubt for being refractious. The singularly unedifying story just shows that quarrelsomeness in congregations is not a phenomenon from which the professed godly were immune in the 16th century. It's an astonishing... I love researching these things. It's incredible. You think, what on earth is this going on here? These people in the 16th century. The man telling the woman that she should... The starch was the devil's liquor. You can imagine the whole thing, can't you? And wearing musk. Then he just she won't bow to him, and so he excommunicates her. If we're to understand the Puritan woman, it is necessary to look at different aspects of the life of such a woman. The field is vast, and material available considerable. Nevertheless, an attempt must be made to give some sketches of the Puritan woman as a Christian. Having done this, to look briefly at childhood and education, courtship, marriage, and motherhood. And let us remember the vast majority of women married, and in such places as New England, because of death through childbearing, women were often in very, very short supply. We will then give attention to the courage of a woman living in an age of danger and persecution, and then finally come to some application to our present age. It is amazing, you see, in New England, people, they died in childbirth, and men, they were farming, they were, what do you do with young children? Little children to bring up. If your wife dies, you're in a terrible condition. You can't work to keep the rest of the family. So there were tremendous pressures, particularly in New England, for marriage. Brilliana Conway, and if you're interested to know why she's called Brilliana, she was the daughter of a man who was the governor of Brill, under Elizabeth in the Netherlands. So he, being the governor of Brill, had a daughter and called her Brilliana. I just have to say that because if you've got the sort of mind I have, you think, Brilliana, what sort of name is this? Well, because she was born in Brill, or he was governor of Brill. Brilliana Conway married Sir Robert Harley as his third wife in July 1623. She kept a commonplace book which dates from 1622. The book contains transcripts from her reading, and is primarily based on the Bible, Calvin Institutes, William Perkins' Cases of Conscience, and his exposition of the Lord's Prayer. The book's concern is principally the mark of the elect and the proof of her religious beliefs. This includes quite clearly her belief in predestination, and her certainty that faith, good works, and obedience to God's law were not, as the Catholics believed, the means of salvation, but were instead the external signs of election. She wrote in her commonplace book, "Man, since his fall, has his will so detained with such bondage to sin that he cannot once move it to goodness. For moving is the beginning of turning to God, which the Scriptures thus give wholly to God. Man, since his fall, sins willingly by his own lusts and by foreign constraint. It is God that first turns our will to that which is good, and we are converted by the power of God only. It is God that works all in us." Not surprisingly, the religion of the Puritan woman in terms of the covenant of grace was the same as that of the Puritan man. She had similar exercises of heart, similar ability to doubts about her election, sat under the same preachers, attending the same family worship, and sought to glorify the same God. While, of course, some Puritan women were born into non-Puritan families and were converted during their early years, many Puritan women were born into Puritan families and grew up under the ordered godliness which characterized these little commonwealths, for so the family was termed. In spite of the caricatures of Puritanism which abound, Puritan families were very loving. As we shall see, the married Puritan woman might expect to have a loving and devoted husband, and such women made most wise and discriminating parents. From earliest years, little Puritan girls would be taught that life was serious, and that diligence and work were aspects of a life pleasing to God. There's a touching instance of this in the letter from Samuel Sewall. This is New England, incidentally. On March the 28th, 1687, he wrote, "I have two small daughters who begin to go to school. My wife would entreat your good lady to pleasure her so far as to buy for her a whole fustian drawn. I must confess I never researched what fustian drawn was. Enough for certain woolen counterpanes for a bed and half a dozen chairs with four threaded green worsted to work it." So he wants this for his daughters, and it says these little seamstresses were Elizabeth and Hannah Sewall, aged 5 and 7 years respectively. So they certainly started their daughters at work very early. As far as the character of the education of the Puritan young lady received, it would depend often upon tutors who were teaching her brothers. She might benefit from their ministrations, although the great emphasis would have been on the education of the boys, so that they could follow their calling in life successfully. The assumption with a girl would be that she would become a wife and mother. Within this context, there were great diversities of accomplishment. Lady Russell, a noted Puritan lady, complained that her inability to spell properly in her letters was due to the inadequacies of her education. On the other hand, we have a woman such as late Lucy Hutchinson, who was exceedingly bookish. Giving an account of her life, she wrote, "By the time I was 4 years old, I read English perfectly. And having a great memory, I was carried to sermons, and while I was very young, could remember and repeat them exactly. And being caressed, the love of praise troubled me and made me attend more heedfully. When I was about 7 years of age, I remember I had at one time 8 tutors in several qualities, languages, music, dancing, writing, and needlework. My father would have me learn Latin, and I was so apt I outstripped my brothers who were at school, although my father's chaplain, that was my tutor, was a pitiful, dull fellow." She's not given to mincing her words. Lucy seemed to have been a formidable, even when young, for she writes, "Play among other children I despise, and when I was forced to entertain such as came to visit me, I tired them with more grave instruction than their mother, plucked all their babies, I mean the dolls, to pieces, and kept the children in such awe that they were glad when I entertained myself with older company." So that's a sort of, if you like, extreme example of Puritan academic pursuits. Courtship followed on from childhood, and interestingly enough, it was Lucy's academic inclinations which, in the providence of God, ended in Colonel Hutchinson, who was the governor of Nottingham Castle during the Civil War, marrying her. Colonel Hutchinson had resisted all previous attempts to lure him into matrimony. Lucy wrote, I don't know whether it was with a sense of triumph, I think he must have been, "In the house with Mr. Hutchinson there was a young gentlewoman of such admirable, tempting beauty and such excellent good nature as would have thawed a rock of ice, that she could never get any acquaintance with him. One day, however, while Mr. Hutchinson was in Lucy's house during her absence, he saw some Latin books belonging to her, and learning to whom they belonged, he began to grow very interested in their owner, although he'd never met her." I don't say, young ladies, I don't know whether any here, if you want a husband, get some Latin books, but anyway, this is absolutely, if you think the Puritans were a dull, uninterested lot, they really weren't. He says here, "Then he grew to love to hear mention of her." I mean, remember, he never met her. And then other gentlewomen who had been her companions used to talk to him of her, telling him how reserved and studious she was, and other things which they esteemed no advantage, so they didn't sort of quite approve of his interest in her. I'll leave you to imagine what's going on. "It is so much inflamed Mr. Hutchinson's desires seeing her that he began to wonder at himself that his heart, which had ever entertained so much indifference for the most excellent of womankind should have such strong impulses towards a stranger he never saw. This is, needless to say, a romance which began in such an unusual way ended up in a marriage of great blessedness and delight. He married her in the end. He seemed to have fallen in love with her when he never even met her, just because of her interest in Latin. My dear friend, I'll leave you to work it out. It is absolutely fascinating. I find it quite fascinating the way God works. Young people that say to me, you know, they say, well, how am I going to meet my husband or how am I going to meet my wife? Well, Hutchinson met his wife by seeing books in Latin. The Puritans had very definite ideas on courtship. Daniel Rogers wrote of poor green leaves who married purely for love. When a year or two has passed and they had skimmed the cream of their marriage, they would soon envy the good fortune of those whose union was built upon stronger foundation. In Matrimonial Honour, Rogers even went so far as to argue that even passionate marriages might actually result in contaminated offspring. They were very rational in their approach to things. I don't say they were not romantic, because if you read, as we shall in a few moments, of the sort of letters that they sometimes wrote to each other, I'm sure if you were a wife or you were a husband, you wouldn't mind getting letters like this from your spouse. But they seem to have been very rational in their approach to marriage. And they considered the matter in a serious and biblical manner. It says, nevertheless, although marriage was not to be entered into, it is of course true that all kinds of consideration came to the choosing of a husband for a Puritan woman. We must remember that she would expect to marry into a family that was basically of similar social standing. It's also true that consideration of dowry and marriage settlements would have a place varying according to the spirituality of her parents. Yet the young would not normally be married against their own wishes. So they weren't like some continental situations where you just married and that was it. Your parents said that and you did it. They were usually given, both male as female, as far as I can understand, they were usually given a sight at least of who it was proposed they would marry. And you've ever read about these things. I remember reading about a young man whose father wanted to marry him off, and he sort of suggested various women, and they would arrange for a meeting. He'd take one look at her and say, "No, thank you very much." But then he arranged for her to see this girl. He just saw her, and she was suitable socially and the whole thing. He said, "All right, you know, okay, let's go ahead with this." But on the basis just of seeing her once, and as far as I can understand, they wouldn't force you to marry someone you absolutely didn't want to marry, normally speaking. At the same time, they would exercise very considerable control over who you did marry. Nevertheless, although marriage was not to be entered into on the basis of passion, but rather in a rational spiritual consideration, yet within marriage, Puritans were immensely loving, and loving within their families. The evidence for this warm love between husband and wife among the Puritans is so copious that one is amazed how the perverted ideas of Puritans as being against conjugal love has gained such an ascendancy. Now, this is what I say, if you were a wife, you wouldn't mind being spoken of like this, would you? Cotton Mather, you must have heard of him, called his second wife a most lovely creature, and such a gift of heaven to me, and more than the sense thereof dissolves me into tears of joy. You don't mind if your husband speaks about you like that, do you? Thomas Hooker wrote, the man who, and this is just amazing, I don't know what your idea of the Puritanism is, but I think it's going to surprise you. The man whose heart is endeared to the woman he loved, dreams of her in the night, hath her in his eye and apprehension when he awakes, muses on her as he sits at the table, walks with her when he travels, and lies in his bosom, and his heart trusts in her, which forces all to confess that the stream of his affection, like a mighty current, runs with full tide and strength. Well, that's quite... Do you think the Puritans were sort of cold and unaffectionate? That's what he wrote about his wife. Or that's what he wrote as an observation of love within marriage. Thus, as Ryken argued, the Puritan exalted women, especially in their role as wife and mother. And quotes Cotton Mather again, women are creatures without which there is no comfortable living for man. They are a sort of blasphemer, then, who despise and decry them and call them a necessary evil, for they are a necessary good. The wives of the Puritans responded with like devotion and affection, and one has only to read the letters of Brilliana Harley and Lady Russell to their husbands to see how they themselves are devoted, affectionate and loving. Thus Betty Bowman, who married Basil Lord Fielding, later Earl of Denbigh, writes, Again, I have to, I don't know whether you write to your husbands like this. My dear heart, my dear life, my sweet joy, P.S. 100,000 kisses I give thee, as I might be as happy as this paper. I long much to see you. She longs to see him, sends in presents of cakes, candied flowers, borage and marigolds. This is all summed up by another ecstatic postscript. Dear, how thy Betty loves thee. That's the Puritan aristocrat. Yes. Of course, marriage, although not in the case of the Countess of Denbigh, ended in childbearing, the occasion of great delight, but alas, often the occasion of death, both for the mother and infant. Must say this because wherever you read, you'll find it. Most women approached childbirth knowing that it could mean their rapid departure from this world. They were thus frequently confronted with a need to prepare for eternity. Death was a frequent visitor to the women of the Puritans, and they knew the excruciating pains of labor and the rapid approach of death as they brought new life into this world. John Winthrop's wife, May, bore her husband 6 children before she died in 1615. He married Thomasina Clapton 6 months later. On Saturday the 30th of November 1616, she was delivered of a daughter who died the following Monday. Now I'm quoting. Next day, Thomasina, a fever seized her and she hemorrhaged. Thomasina asked that the bell of Groton Church should be tolled for her so that her neighbor should know that she lay on her deathbed and would visit and pray for her. By Saturday, the fever had become strong. She prayed vehemently to God to overcome the tempting devil and not to remove his loving kindness from her, as we might see by her setting her teeth and fixing her eyes, shaking her head and whole body. She took farewell of her family and household. John continued to pray by her bedside and discourse with her of the sweet love of Christ unto her and of his glory that she was going unto, and what a holy everlasting Sabbath she would keep, and how she would... wife was clearly in subjection to her husband. He was the head of this little commonwealth. But as Winthrop wrote, a true wife accounts her subjection her honour and freedom. I would not think her condition safe and free, but in subjection to her husband's authority. Such is the liberty of the church under the authority of Christ, her king and husband. His yoke is so easy and sweet as a bride's ornament. But as a wife under authority, she had authority and care over her children. On the spiritual side, she labored and prayed for their salvation. I'm quoting, the tender mother will own no other of all her numerous brood, but such as stand at Christ's right hand, acquitted through his blood. She not only traveled in body for their physical birth, but she labored in spirit for their spiritual birth. And yet the women, Puritan women, certainly cared for their children's bodies. When Edward Harley was at Oxford, that's the son, one of the sons of Brilliana Harley, his mother sent him licorice for colds, eye water for sore eyes, and to preserve the sight, an aureum potabile, literally drinkable gold, tiny slivers of gold to be drunk in water and believed to be a powerful restorative. In spite of her husband's protestations, she also sent pies made from turkey, pigeon and kid, presents of bacon and sweetmeats for Lent, a loin of veal, apples and violet cakes. So I don't know whether you go in for providing your children with food at university, but if you do, you're in good Puritan Puritan tradition. Or whether you provide violet cakes and loins of veal and pies of turkey, pigeon and kid. Anyway, no doubt something modern equivalent. Puritan women were, on the whole, immensely hard-working. One supposes the question may be asked whether a study of Puritan women sheds any light on whether Christian wives should, inverted commas, go out to work. Conditions were so different in the centuries we are studying that it is extremely difficult to make valid comparisons. What is clear is that the Puritan woman from a reasonably prosperous background was immensely hard-working. Thus Elizabeth Walker, who married in 1650, began her day at 4 o'clock in the morning, and sometimes as early as 2 or 3, so that she had hours of solitary meditation. At 6, the servants were summoned for reading from the Bible and prayers, and the day labourers came after breakfast. During the day, she would engage in needlework and inspecting the dairy. During the noontime, she would be spent visiting the sick, distributing salves and medicine. Mrs. Walker would also visit women in childbirth, rising at any hour of the night. She seems to have been a prodigious cook, who at the last wedding anniversary, and how she enveloped 39 pies in one dish. How she did this, I don't know. I don't know whether you want to have a try. I'm sorry if I say these things. 39 pies in one dish. The Countess of Warwick, who embraced Puritanism after conversion, rose at 6, visited 6 servants, the village school, girls' school, and administered medicines, which were mainly herbal remedies prepared at home. Though there was a continual emphasis on a wife's submission, yet how this worked out in practice is somewhat of a rebuke to the more extreme and, should we say, ignorant modern male neo-Puritans. I'd like to, if you've met them, I don't know whether you have. I've met them before marriage and afterwards. Before marriage, they're full of big talk, and I've seen them afterwards and being led around like a sort of Pekingese on a leaf. Sorry, but I have. It says here, I have met them though, haven't you? Samuel Sewell, for instance, recalls that he delegated the family finances to his wife because she had, quote, a better faculty than I at managing affairs. Mather wrote that particular exception to the husband's authority may have place if she exceeds her husband in prudence and dexterity. Whilst William Goode said, there are many things in well governing a family more fit for one to meddle with all than for the other. Common sense should surely teach a rationally minded husband that in some areas of intellect and practice, competence in his wife is superior to his own. If you don't think your wife is superior to you in anything, I think you must... Perhaps you don't know your own deficiencies. It says, even Calvin, and you may be surprised at this, commenting on 1 Peter 5:5, writes, the husband is the head of the wife, yet he is to be in some things subject to her. Unfortunately or fortunately, Calvin fails to inform us what these things are. But you can read in his commentary. It's quite fascinating. There should be short that sin had disappeared from the Puritan era and that marriage among Puritans was always unalloyed happiness. It must be recorded that this was not the case. Adair in his Founding Fathers writes, the English characteristic of aggressiveness also surfaced in the home, especially in the ill treatment of wives. The Plymouth magistrates punished a man for abusing his wife by kicking her from the stool to the fire. However, violence was not only one way, for in 1655, Tony Miller of Taunton appeared before a court charged with beating and reviling her husband, egging her children to help her, bidding them to knock him on the head, and with wishing that his victuals might choke him. The wife of Christopher Collins was presented for railing at her husband and calling him a girly gutted devil. Although as she was discharged, Morgan supposed the court must have agreed with her estimation of him. I just read these things out. Even the most pious of husbands and wives could occasionally disagree. It is recorded of Oliver Hayward, the great Puritan preacher of Lancashire, that he unwarily invited a houseful of guests without consulting his wife. He discovered that she had other and quite different plans. Hayward quickly read the danger signals and offered to write at once and cancel the suggested visit. They spent a troubled day, followed by a restless night. After tossing and turning till 2 a.m., she rose. When he followed her, he found her with her Bible open before her. He suggested that they might pray. She demurred, but he ventured to begin, found right words and plenteous opening of heart, and they were reconciled. With gratitude, he recorded in his diary that prayer was always his sovereign remedy, and that never failed. But next morning, he wrote to cancel the arrangements he had so rashly made. Oliver Hayward, I try to give these people a human face, you see. And if you don't look out, you don't think of the Puritans as even being human. But they obviously were human, and their wives were human, their husbands were human. And although you have to sort of dig around for this, they had their difficulties sometimes. It may be well to conclude this section of the paper by returning to the theme with which we began, namely the sheer courage and resolution that these women so often showed. In an age when neo-Puritan men so often appear to be womanish, it is immensely encouraging to find Christian women who showed such resolution while retaining in all its beauty their femininity, and they manifested a holy boldness. I might say if a Christian woman today is molested and turns to Christian men for help, thinking that some knight-errant will come rushing to help, she may also discover those who are called men refusing to help her and are hiding behind some specious pretense, whilst really they are cowards who shrink from the trouble that any intervention might bring them, and piously talk while leaving the poor woman without help. I don't know what you thought I was going to say about the Puritan. I don't lay into the women, that's not my part. I have to be courteous, I lay into the men. You see, that's what I can do that without any difficulty. The feminine virtues of Lady Brilliana Harley are well documented. A loving wife and devoted mother, she was left to conduct the defence of Brampton Bryan against Raleigh's assault. This was the family castle very near the Welsh border, if you went to sort of into Herefordshire, north of Hereford, just south of Shropshire. Brampton Bran is still there, though I think the castle is in ruins. The siege lasted 7 weeks, and she was surrounded by a 700-strong force of horse and foot soldiers. Inside the castle, there were 50 musketeers and 50 civilians, men, women, and children. Lady Harley resolutely defied calls for surrender and, quote, taking full advantage of her position, and this is very splendid, I think, as a woman, she argued she could only act on Sir Robert's, that's her husband's, instructions. And since she did not know he would approve this plan, she could not take the decision herself, because I never will voluntarily betray the trust my husband reposes in me. And he was in London, so she says, well, I'm under his authority, and I can't possibly surrender without his direction, so I'm going to go on fighting you. Which I found very, very interesting, a sort of woman's in intellectual subtlety. Just as moving an account is the account of Grizzel Hume, later Lady Bailey of Jerviswood, who at the age of 17 or 18, when her father was hiding the family vault from the Stuart persecution of the Covenanters, went to creep through the churchyard every night at midnight. She went in fear and trembling at every noise. She supposed to be soldiers searching for her father. If they caught him, that was likely his death. The first night, the dogs of the nearby manse, who seemed to favour the Stuart cause, barked with great violence. Her mother then hit on the scheme of persuading the minister that these dogs were really mad and exceedingly dangerous. So skillful were her persuasions that the minister promptly hanged them the next day. I don't know whether this appeals to you. It does to me. It really does. So she got rid of the dogs. It says here, so night after night, Grizzel went and sat with her father in the vault where the skeletons of his ancestors were interred. Through her ministrations, her father's life was sustained, and eventually he escaped to Holland. I think perhaps I have time to tell you two additional little snippets in relation to what happened there. One is that because they could never trust the servants, they didn't know, it was very difficult to get the food. And she used to sit at the table, and when no one was looking, she would get all the food off her plate onto her apron, and then cover it up and then take it out, because how do you take food out, you see? And one day there was some sheep's head, and her younger brother said, oh, greedy Grizzel, she's eaten the whole sheep's head. And she disappeared into her lap. The other thing is, and perhaps I don't know whether you ladies are nervous, but the fact is that this man, Hume, the name that her father was in the vault of his ancestors, and he saw a skull, and the skull kept on moving, He had a little light, I think, kept on moving and moving and moving. Then he said, out from the skull came a mouse who was feeding on his ancestors' brains. Right? Well, you say, yes, Grizzel, she goes down into the tomb at midnight, that's okay, isn't it? I wonder whether it would be okay with skulls lying around. She was a brave woman. It says here, through her ministrations, her father's life was sustained, and eventually she escaped to Holland. It's now necessary to come to some conclusions and to relate what has been said about the Puritan woman to the present situation. First, it is essential we consider the Puritan woman as she really was. The subtitle of Leyden Ryken's book, Worldly Saints, is The Puritans as They Really Were. Puritanism has come in for massive abuse and disinformation. The Puritan woman was not some stereotypical Victorian matron, and that is not meant to imply any derogatory evaluation of the Victorian. While she was godly, she was also human. As a woman, she desired to be loved. Elizabeth Walker would ask her husband, smiling, dost thou love me? On one occasion, Dr. Walker was telling her why he loved her and began first for conscience. She stopped him. I would have thee love me, not because thou must, but because thou wilt, not as a duty, but a delight. For, she added, we are prone to reluctate against what is imposed, but to take pleasure in what we choose. These Puritan women had husbands who really loved them. We see this in their lives, but we learn it in their husbands' lamentation over their deaths. Daniel Fine, later second Earl of Nottingham, on his wife's death, wrote, For I have surely a better friend, a wife without her equal, and that I loved as myself, for she was willing even to die to wean me from this world, that we might meet in a better and live together eternally. I can say once I had the best woman in the world. While the Puritan minister Oliver Heywood, on the death of his first wife, Elizabeth Orkney, wrote of her, "The mirror of patience and subjection in her relation as a child, as a wife, and, and tenderness and care, as a sister and as a mother. I want her at every time, everywhere, and in every work. Methinks I am but half myself without her." Secondly, you will notice nothing has been said of the role of the Puritan woman in the church. This is mainly because her principal role is within the family as wife and mother. And because apart from the Quakers in exceptional circumstances such as that of Anne Hutchinson, there was no question of women teaching in the church. Perkins wrote, "It is not warrantable for a woman by God's word to administer the sacrament of baptism. Women are not allowed to preach, no, not in case of necessity where men are wanting." While Robinson declares, "They are so debarred by their sexes from ordinary prophesying," they'll be preaching, not charismatic of us, "so from any other dealing in the charge wherein they take authority over the man." He does, however, say, "In cases extraordinary, namely where no man will, I see not but a woman may reprove the church rather than suffer it to go on in apparent wickedness and commensurate with it therein. Neither is the respect of persons with God in the common duties of Christianity." I want to say, of course, that you've seen, I say, in the church, you can see they were massively taken up with ministering to the poor and helping in all kinds of what we would today call social activities. They accepted responsibility in their communities, no doubt for the people who they were related to by their spiritual affinities, but also the ordinary people around them. And if they were good Puritan and they had money, they would dispense it to the poor and they would recognize their responsibilities there. Thirdly, these women were being willing to take a line which was totally contrary to the world about them. The Puritan woman would know well such text as, "The world cannot hate you, but me it hateth, because I testified of it that the works thereof are evil. And they are of the world, therefore speak they of the world, and the world heareth them." We should not expect to find the Puritan woman dressing according to the dictates of some 16th century Mary Quant or Carnaby Street and arguing that if her dress incite lust in men, then that is their fault and she must dress like her worldly friends if she is going to be able to witness to them, which is a sort of argument you can sometimes hear in these days. Nor for that matter would she regard her children as kids, that's little goats. I hope I'm treading on your toes hard. "The upbringing of which was an inadequate sphere for her great talents and abilities," which I've heard some women, not that any of you would be like that, but I have heard women say, "You know, bringing up children, all my abilities," or, "Oh," I say, what contempt you have for, sorry, please, I think, you know, you can string me up by the lamppost afterwards, but I say, what children? I thought they had eternal souls. And frankly, I found bringing up children incredibly difficult. I don't know what you ladies and men think. It's not easy, is it? It's very, very difficult. So it says here, not for that matter would she regard her children as kids, little goats, the upbringing which was an inadequate sphere for her great talents and abilities. The Puritan woman would have seen through such monstrous nonsense, for it was a devaluing of the souls of her children. To say she would be content with her lot as a wife and mother would be a grievous understatement. She gloried in the role of wife and mother. We must, of course, recognize here that because of the high death rate in childbirth, women often tended to be in very short supply. And so very rarely were the Puritan women who faced the problem of evangelical women today who have to lead a single life. It's just a matter of fact that death was so common. And death came early. It came both to men and women, of course. The death rate was so high that there were some. You do find one or two, but it was very, very rare. Similarly, in education, the emphasis would be on the education of men, yet many Puritan households would have been significantly ahead of the age. The Puritan family would not have agreed with the comment of James I, who, when it was suggested his daughter, Elizabeth, should learn Latin, replied, "To make a woman learned and foxes tame had the same effect to make them more cunning," and he forbade it. Forgive me saying this, but I just had to give this quotation. Let us remember also that in the period 1550 to 1700, which we have looked at, it's a very different age from our own, both nationally and spiritually. While we live in an age of national degeneration, indeed of disintegration, the Elizabethan age was one in which the very idea of what it was to be English came to be more clearly defined. Certainly, under Charles II, with the Dutch fleet sailing up the Thames, burning British ships, and with the moral degeneracy of Charles II and James II handing over our nation once again to Roman domination, we have something nearer to our own age. But even here, the parallels are limited. Let us remember that the Puritan era was one of immense spiritual activity, indeed of a kind of revival. In 1662, there were 2,000 ejected ministers. You all know about this, the origins of nonconformity. Out of a population of 4,750,000, making the roughest of comparisons, we would say in similar circumstances today, would be like finding 20,000 men willing to leave their homes and stipends over a matter of biblical principle. We live in a very different age, not only politically, but spiritually. 2,000 ministers in a population of 4,750,000. This is all rough. But you think to yourself, you amplify it and say, well, you'd find 2,000 ministers today who would be willing to be ejected over a matter of principle? Well, I worked this up, 20,000. So the situation spiritually was different than it is today. Let us remember that Puritan women were women often with Puritan fathers, Puritan brothers, Puritan husbands, and Puritan ministers. Our much admired Brilliana Harley would have been happy to attend a fast day, the character of which is thus described. That's talking of her ministers. Upon such a day, Mr. Gower will go into the pulpit between 8 and 9 o'clock in the morning, and there pray and preach extempore until past 1 o'clock following. Then they sang a psalm, but Mr. Gower cometh not forth from the pulpit to past 5 o'clock following, if daylight continues so long. Now, I don't know what you say, what were the Puritan women like? Well, I'm just telling you that Lady Brilliana Hardy doesn't write about this as complaining at the length of the preaching. She just says they start at 8 or 9, they sing a psalm in the middle, and he goes on till 5. My mind reeled. I really did reel at that. But then it may be, of course, that explains why they were as tough as they were. And believe me, Brennan, I think they were tough. And they were spiritual and they were holy. Bemused by strident feminism, there are those who would agitate for more female power to be exercised in the church. It could be argued that what evangelicalism needs is not more feminine influence, but less. And this is where I'm sorry if I tread on your toes anyway. Of course, there are many, there may not be de jure female ministers, I mean in evangelical circles, elders and deacons, but if de facto the minister, elders and deacons are dominated by their wives, you just get petticoat government by proxy. It's true, isn't it? I was always told about I've got to say that I can say about the brethren, that the elders rule. Yes, said someone to me, so it's the wives who rule the elders, so it's the women who rule the church. All right. But it does happen, doesn't it? It does. Sorry. You're realistic to know that, aren't you? You're realistic enough to know what I'm talking about. Once you get like this, there are dangers of getting churches governed not on the basis of biblical principle of righteousness, but churches where sentiment exercises too great an influence. Thus, Mary Cassian, a Canadian evangelical, has written about feminism, writes, "Ideas that were once considered radical and bizarre are now considered conventional. Feminist wisdom is ever being forwarded by officials in the highest level of the judicial system. For example, Canadian Supreme Court Justice Bertha Wilson, in a speech to the Osgoode Hall Law School in February of 1990, called for the transformation of the law along feminist principles and for the re-education of her male colleagues in summer schools on sexism. She endorsed the idea proposed by second-phase feminist philosophers that women are more caring and inherently nicer than men." And I don't know whether you'd think that if you were under Jezebel and Herodias, but still. "And that they are less concerned than men with abstract notions of justice, less preoccupied with what is right and wrong, and hence less inclined to separate their feelings from their thinking. She went on to chastise her fellow judges for relying too much on the evidence of a case, instead of entering into the skin of the litigant and making his or her experience part of your experience, and only when you have done that to judge. According to Wilson, a woman who has suffered at the hands of a particular man could not readily be judged as guilty in the murder of that man. The implications of these feminist notions are radical and drastic to the traditional practice of law and justice, and yet it says they hardly met a raised eyebrow. Little public debate resulted, just a praising article in a leading national newspaper." should be remembered that for Isaiah, female rule among the people of God is a sign of divine judgment. As for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. O my people, they which lead thee cause thee to err and destroy the way of thy paths. You may ask whether I'm saying that feminism and undue female influence is the cause of our present troubles in many areas. I have no doubt it is a cause, but not the cause. When Adam sinned, he blamed his wife. The woman whom thou gavest to be with me, she gave me of the tree and I did eat. That's Genesis 3, verse 11. That God rejected Adam's whinging abdication of his responsibilities is evidenced by the fact that God testifies, for since by man came death, by man came also the resurrection of the dead, for as in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. It does not say as in Eve all died, nor does it say for as by one woman's disobedience many were made sinners, but by one man's disobedience many were made sinners. It's Romans 5:19. Whilst not suggesting that Elizabeth I was a Puritan, her statement made when addressing her troops at the time of the Armada on August 19, 1588 at Tilbury may be adapted here. Quote, I am come to live or to die amongst you all, to lay down for my God and for my kingdom and for my people my honour and my blood even in the dust. I know I have the body of a weak, feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king, and a king of England too. And think foul scorn that Palmer of Spain or any prince of Europe should dare to invade the border of my realm. Now, some of your supposed modern neo-Puritan men would have to say, I have the body of a strong and vigorous man, but I have a pusillanimous spirit. And if I see the church under attack and corrupted by evil or some man or woman being molested, I will at all costs avoid trouble and by administrative stratagems and pious platitudes under a guise of spirituality avoid doing anything to help such women or cleanse the church. I stand by that. The trouble, ladies, it's not your fault. I started off with a great respect for the Puritan woman. I ended up with a much greater respect than I began. If we are as men, we must on the one hand avoid the kind of male macho neo-Puritan who speaks great swelling words and alienates thinking women from such misrepresentations of manhood. As I said, there's Christian men and even Christian husbands who are afraid to admit that women in general and wives in particular may be actually superior in intellect and ability to men do no good to the cause of Christ. It is nonsense. Of course women are cleverer than some of you men. Of course there are cleverer women. That's obvious, isn't it? The Bible doesn't tell us to fly in the face of reality in some intellectual areas. My wife has a degree in mathematics. I stopped doing maths at GCSE. She once tried to teach me some maths. We didn't get on very well. And I decided after that I wouldn't learn maths from my wife. But that I'm a better mathematician than she is palpable rubbish, isn't it? Absolute rubbish, nonsense. But you do find men, and I don't know, you may have met with sort of men who sort of picked up some strange ideas about these things, and they go around throwing their weight around and talking very big and so forth and so on. But this is not an intellectual, and women may be in many ways more able than men in terms of administration and organization. Of course they are. Of course they may be. I don't say they are. But there are differences among men and differences among women. And women are not, the Bible never says they're intellectually inferior or males are intellectually superior. I just have to say this, I found men sometimes extraordinarily boastful and just plain stupid. Forgive me for saying, but it's true. And this put the women listen to this and they say, well, is this what the Bible actually teaches about male headship? The Bible does not teach that, as we've seen here, haven't we, that the Puritans said, well, in some things women are more competent than men. This particular man says, I'm quite happy to let my wife run the financial affairs of my household because she's more competent than I am. Now, he doesn't renounce his authority. He just says it's self-evident that I'm very thankful I've got a wife who's like that, and I'm very happy for her to get on with it. But I think it is important because there are misunderstandings, and you do meet with people like this. And it can be off-putting, I think, to young ladies when they meet with this kind of thing. It is indeed strange, and I just leave this, I haven't really worked it out myself, The two periods of national greatness have been when we haven't had a queen on the throne, Elizabeth I and Victoria. But under the libidinous and lecherous Charles II, our nation was reduced to a kind of bondage. Deborah in the book of Judges was raised up of God and was a reproach to the want of manhood in Barak. I think one has to think to yourself, this is the kind of line we need to think about. But do we not need real men in the church? And the trouble is that in a church whose ethos is feminine, where women exercise undue control and influence, any man worth the name is going to feel uncomfortable. There is here a vicious circle which needs to be broken, because we should ask, can an effeminate evangelicalism stand before the energy of a masculine Islam, or for that matter, a militant resurgent Marxism? Do you follow me? I leave you to think about that. Churches which are ruled by women, will they stand before for want of a better word, the virility of Islam? I very much doubt it. But before that of militant Marxism, which certainly in the past made a great deal about women's rights and so on. But I went to Russia years ago, and the only women I could see prominent for their masculine activities were the women digging the road up. And a man, a sort of ex-communist, when I was in a meeting with communist propagandists, nudged me. He said, ask first of all. I didn't do so, but he said, ask the position of women under communism. And then, when they've answered, ask how many women there are on the Supreme Soviet. He said, there was one, but she was kicked off for corruption, and there aren't any. It was interesting, wasn't it? He said, oh yes, you come, and they say, oh yes, we give women positions. But he said, you look. He said, they don't have it. They don't. Or they do have it, because they can dig up the roads. And that's their equality with men, doing the most menial and sort of debased tasks. Some neo-Puritan men seem to think it is an evidence of their spirituality to crush their wives. Possible, isn't it? I once met a man, he annoyed me in America. I went there, he asked all sorts of questions. I just wanted to see whether you crushed your wife and daughters. I was rather offended by this, I must say. But anyway, that is not biblical. The wife is to be a helpmeet to her husband, not some kind of doormat upon which he wipes his feet. Let us hear Gattaca. It is no shame for a woman to be housewifely, be she never as well born, be she never so wealthy. For it is the woman's trade to be, it is the end of her creation. It is that she was, is that she was made for. She was made for man and given to man, not to be a playfellow or a bedfellow or a table mate, only with him, and yet to be all of these two, but to be a yoke fellow, a work fellow, a fellow labourer with him, to be an assistant and helper unto him in the managing of such domestic and household affairs. Art thou to make any choice of a wife? Choose thee an housewife. It is no shame for thee, though thou beest wealthy, to seek her at the wash house, seek her at the needle, at the wheel, at the spindle. It is no disgrace for any to be found and taken at such employments. Which I've been telling my daughters, I don't know if it's ever worked, but I say, well, how did Isaac get his wife? Well, Rebecca, what was she doing? She would water the camels, didn't she? It's very strange, this, but if you read the book of Genesis, she was very willing. She got a nice nature. And she was hard working. And that is where the messenger, the servant of Abraham, found her. And if I remember rightly, that is where Jacob also found Rachel, wasn't he? Watering the sheep. I don't know. I have to say this. The Puritans were sensible. What do you look for in a wife? Well, hear what Gattaca said. Again, in a fashion which serves well to climax and to close this topic, Gattaca proclaims the functions of wife as helpmate. It is not good, saith God, for man to be alone. I will make him an help, or an assistant, not a mate only, but an helper, not a companion only, but an assistant too. Man being a creature of the kind, not of those that love only to a flock and live together, but of those that desire to combine and work and labour also together. Now behold here a fit and ready help. For who fitter to help man than she whom God himself hath fitted for man, and made for this very end to be a fit help for him? I will make him such an help, saith God, as shall be meet for him, one that shall be as his match, one that is in all points and abilities, you notice this, in a manner as himself. And certainly as there are offices not a few, that none in many cases so fitly perform about a man as a wife may, so there is no help that he hath, so ordinarily can have, so ready at all times as his help. So if you're an able man, I suggest you seek an able wife, one able to be your companion. That's right, that is right. You don't seek a wife you could... I don't know if there are many young unmarried men here. So I'm just talking, as it were, to the committed already. But you don't look for a woman you can throw your weight around with, do you? You look for a companion who is suitable for you. That's what the Puritans said. If we have daughters, then while it is true that they should be taught that in marriage submission to their husband is a sign of true spirituality, yet we should bring them up and seek to educate them that they are fit to be worthy helpmeets for their husbands. So by their spirituality they may bring great blessings to them. As Proverbs says of a virtuous woman, she will do him good and not evil all the days of her life. Her children arise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. So let us study the Puritan woman, let us learn from her example, and let us pray that in this degenerate age God will raise up men and women of such like godliness who are willing to suffer for the sake of Christ and unwilling to conform to the pattern of a rotting age. Let us pray that God will raise up Christian men worthy to be husbands of such women. I have to say this, I wonder how the Puritan woman would have got on looking for a suitable husband in the 20th century. I really do. I don't know. They were magnificent women, but they were tough, and they were able, and they were strong-minded, and they were strong-willed. I just say that as a sort of passing comment. Such women will be an honour to their parents and a blessing to their husbands, a true mother to their children, an ornament to the church, and lastly, more important, they will be included in the scriptures. They shall be mine, saith the Lord of hosts, in that day when I make up my jewels, which is Malachi 3 verse 17.